I'm Katie Clark, and this is The World. 50 years ago this week, Fidel Castro and his communist regime came to power in Cuba. An ailing Castro has stepped back from the spotlight and turned the presidency over to his younger brother, Raul. Still, Fidel continues to loom large. Dan Erickson explores the tense history between the U.S. and Cuba in his book, The Cuba Wars, Fidel Castro, the United States, and the Next Revolution. He says after all these years, Cuba's become almost an afterthought in U.S. foreign policy circles.
In the 1960s, it played a central role during the Cold War, of course, with the Bay of Pigs invasion and then the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, Cuba really ceased to become or be a foreign policy issue and was thought much more along the lines of domestic electoral politics. And as a result, people in Washington often don't see Cuba as a foreign policy problem, as a domestic problem, and in particular, how to navigate the very rocky terrain of the Cuban-American exile community in Florida.
I love the quote that you include from former U.S. diplomat Wayne Smith, who famously said, "Cuba seems to have the same effect on American administrations as the full moon has on werewolves." And is the reverse also true? I mean, does the U.S. evoke an equally visceral response among the ruling elite in Havana?
I think among many members of the ruling elite, it does. Of course, one of the great ironies, and there's many ironies of the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba, but one of them is certainly that despite all of this official political hostility between the two governments, the United States and Cuba remain very interconnected along terms of culture, immigration, where you have over 1 million Cuban Americans living in the United States, many of whom travel back frequently to Cuba. And the U.S. just last year was actually Cuba's fifth largest trading partner due to an exemption that was offered to U.S. companies several years ago that allows them to sell food to Cuba on all cash basis.
Yeah, I mean, there's been this decades-long U.S. embargo on Cuba. And one of the big things that appears to be an inconsistency in that embargo is this also growing trade in tractors and farm equipment and things like that. How much of a role does that play now in U.S. exports?
Well, in terms of the agricultural sector, it's a small but significant portion. Cuba is the 25th largest export market for U.S. agricultural products, which isn't too bad considering that there's basically a comprehensive American embargo on the island, with the exception of that one small category of trade. And of course, for Cuba, it's quite important. In addition to this, you have remittances which are sent to Cuba from Cuban Americans living in the United States, which total at least $500 million annually, perhaps more. And of course, you have tourism as well, both legal tourism, which is allowed for some academic and humanitarian groups, as well as the estimated 25,000 embargo busters that travel to Cuba through third countries each year.
Well, that embargo that has been on Cuba, imposed by the U.S. in the early 1960s, that was initially put in place to contain Cuba as a potential security threat. What is the rationale for keeping them?
Well, I think that the rationale for the sanctions has changed over time. And as you said, that during the Cold War, it really was an effort to contain Cuban communism, particularly at a time when the Soviet Union was seen as such a threat. And when the Cold War ended in the early 1990s, then the rhetoric really began to shift much more towards democracy and human rights and trying to bring an end to the Castro government. Unfortunately, however, the sanctions have not been particularly effective in trying to hasten some form of political change in Cuba. And if anything, they've probably done the opposite. I would argue that isolation from the United States has actually been one of the core political strategies of the Cuban government that has allowed it to stay in power for decades.
And where do you see U.S. policy toward Cuba going with the Obama administration?
Well, Barack Obama said several very interesting things about Cuba during the course of his presidential campaign. The first was that he said that he would end the ban on Cuban Americans who want to travel back to Cuba to visit their families, which could really potentially open the floodgates for much more travel from the United States to Cuba. The second thing Obama said is that he would like to initiate some type of dialogue with the Cuban government. And then the third thing is Barack Obama said that he would maintain the embargo until Cuba moved towards some type of democratic reform. As we all know, governing is sometimes very different than campaigning, but I think those will be basically the starting point of whatever type of policy he develops towards Cuba.
Can U.S. policy toward Cuba change without the blessing of the Cuban-American community in Florida?
Well, I think it's very interesting right now. The different factions in the Cuban American community are giving their blessing to different actors right now. But I think that more than the Cuban American community, it's really the U.S. Congress, which plays a central role here. Because in the 1990s, several major pieces of legislation were passed, which codified the U.S. embargo into law. And there's only so much Obama can do before he'll need to go back to the U.S. Congress and ask permission.
Have you seen any significant changes in Cuba under Raul Castro?
There's a few changes that Raul Castro has implemented. During March and April, he really began to lift a series of restrictions on the access of Cuban citizens to consumer goods, such as DVDs, cell phones, computers. And he also implemented some new reforms in the agricultural sector. Since then, I think you've seen a little bit of a closing down of that momentum. It might have to do with the fact that Fidel Castro, although he has been quite ill, appears to be playing a bigger role. He's been writing more publicly, and he seems to have regained some of his health.
Well, let me ask you again. I mean, why is Cuba important? Why should it be important to the incoming administration and to everyday Americans?
Well, I think there's probably three reasons I would give you. The first is that the U.S.-Cuban relationship is really one of the last big pieces of unfinished business from the Cold War, and there needs to be a much more modern perspective on this relationship. Secondly, there's a very interesting geopolitical game that's being played out in Latin America today, where Cuba is an important piece of it. And that entails both the rise of Brazil and Venezuela as regional powers that have global ambitions. You also have China and Russia, who have become increasingly engaged in Latin America. And in fact, in November, the presidents of both China and Russia visited Cuba. And I think that U.S. absence from Cuba does not do much to favor the U.S. national interest. And then the third reason I would state is that Cuba is important to the U.S. because it has had such an impact on the United States. If you look back to the 2000 election, which took place right after Elian Gonzalez, the 6-year-old boy who was picked up off the shores of Florida, lived in Miami with relatives for some time, and then was returned to his family in Cuba.
In a very dramatic way.
Exactly, in a very dramatic way, seized at gunpoint, actually, by U.S. federal agents, and then returned to his father in Cuba. At that time, Fidel Castro was very unpopular, but Janet Reno was even more unpopular.
Former Attorney General in the Clinton administration, yeah.
Exactly, for Cuban Americans there. And the Cuban Americans basically abandoned the Democratic Party, voted 80% for then Texas Governor George Bush. And George Bush ended up winning the presidency by 537 votes in the state of Florida, which allowed him to win that state's electoral vote.
So Cuba, the U.S.-Cuba relationship has been influencing present-day U.S. presidential elections, you say?
That's correct. It's no exaggeration to say that if Elian Gonzalez had stayed in Cuba, there never would have been a Bush presidency at all, because it was precisely his arrival and the galvanizing effect that it had on the Cuban-American community that produced George Bush's victory in Florida and allowed him to become the president.
Dan Erickson is with the Inter-American Dialogue, a think tank based in Washington, D.C. His book is The Cuba Wars, Fidel Castro, the United States, and the Next Revolution. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you for having me.
This is PRI.